Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Joel Hargis, an instrument-rated private pilot who flies regularly around Florida and the Southeast for business in his Mooney. Joel is EAA Chapter 534 President and Young Eagle Coordinator promoting aviation.
Hello, I'm Joel Hargis with the Florida Aviation Network, and we are here in Lakeland, Florida at Sun and Fun 2022. Another great air show, incredible attendance this year. We got the Thunderbirds in town for the show this year, and just a whole bunch of airplanes, some bunch of warbirds. We're just having a great show. And today, we're going to interview author Tom Upson. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Joel.
Yeah, Tom, so you've been flying pretty much your whole life.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be raised by a flight surgeon father who obviously was exposed to the aviation at a very early age, and dragged him out to the airport as much as I could. Finally earned enough money to get up to solo when I was 16 in a Cessna 150 in Cairo, Georgia, down in South Georgia. Great ag businesses there, but I was, you know, just learning, getting my wings pinned on.
So soloed at 16.
Soloed at 16.
And sure, let me guess, check ride at 17.
Yep.
One of those guys.
You're
so lucky. I would have given anything to have been exposed to that at that age, you know. So, you said you soloed in the 150. Did you check ride in that?
I did, and it went well. I remember the examiner was an old World War II pilot. He had flown Corsairs, and his last name was Fitzgerald, and which he told me was a German-American name. And he said, you know, we gave him, you know, that airplane did a great job for him in World War II.
And which airplane was that again?
He was flying a Corsair.
Oh, a Corsair.
Yeah.
In the Pacific, I guess.
Huh? Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
He didn't talk a lot about it, but he was a great pilot.
Yeah, that's a great airplane, and did a great role for us in the South Pacific, for sure.
It really did.
So, you told me another thing. You actually got to go, accepted, into the Air Force Academy.
I sure did. I was lucky enough to get appointed and was able to attend and got really excited about, even more excited about aviation, because we had a soaring program there in the Rockies, and it was spectacular conditions, and I got my instructor rating and sailplanes to add to the single and multi-engine that I had was able to get as well.
And so you actually had a commercial, did you have a CFI prior to that?
I think I did. I believe
academy?
I did, yeah.
Wow, well, you were a busy young man.
Yeah, it's been quite a while ago, but I believe, yeah, it was exciting. And out there you have the mountain wave, so you have some really intense soaring conditions.
So obviously you've flown a lot of planes over the years. Is it true what I hear that if you can fly a glider, master a glider, that's probably the best stick and rudder training?
I think so.
Some of the best.
I think so. It teaches you energy management, you get a lot of confidence, you know, without having an engine.
Dead stick.
It's all dead stick. So, you know, if something happens where you do lose your engine, which unfortunately has happened to me before, then your glider, and you've got the, you have the foundation to get it on the ground like Sully did.
He was actually a glider instructor at the academy was he not?
Yeah, he sure was. And so I think it builds a foundation that can be used in any branch of aviation. Plus, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Nice and quiet, and you're soaring with, you know, different raptors and it's beautiful.
Quiet.
To get up there quiet, and you can't beat that wind noise is all you get. No engine noise.
A little whistle of the wind.
It's perfect.
That's awesome. And And so, as I understand, as I was talking to you earlier, you chose not to fly for the Air Force.
I did. I decided to become a physician, and
which your dad was.
Which exactly, and that went into the ear, nose, and throat specialty, which fit, you know, the aerospace world quite well, and so I was able to do my general and surgical subspecialty, and at the same time I went ahead and got my examiner's FAA aviation medical examiner's designation.
Sure.
And so throughout private practice I was a medical examiner for
AME
FAA
for
20 something years with the FAA, became a senior examiner, so I was able to help the airline captains in my area as well.
Wow, that gets you hanging around with a lot of pilots. I mean, I have a personal friend that's an AME, and so
yeah,
he tells me a few stories once in a while. What he can tell me, right? Because I know that's all confidential. But so you've kind of figured out a way to use your physician skills and knowledge and attach it to aviation.
Yes, I wanted to continue to participate in aviation as much as I could. One of the things that I volunteered to do was be the team doctor for the U.S. Unlimited aerobatic team. Every 2 years there's a world championship somewhere in, usually in Europe, but different locations, sometimes here. And so I did that for a couple of times and got to know a lot of these great aerobatic pilots. A lot of them are here this week doing performances here at Sun and Fun. And what a talented crew. And my job was very easy, but, you know, sometimes things come up and you got to deal with it on the spot and keep them flying safe and healthy and take care of the families. And so it was a real honor to be able to support our country and our outstanding aerobatic unlimited pilots.
You know, that raises a question. So obviously when these guys are flying aerobatics and pulling 6+ G's and 3 or 4 negatives sometimes, I mean, just ungodly G's. I mean, you got to be in shape to do that, number one. But let me ask you, as the flight surgeon, what kind of maladies did they have as a result of that extreme flying? What was common?
Well, you know, the typical things that come up occasionally, an upper respiratory infection where they'd have some sinus drainage or headaches. But one of the things that they would often run into, unfortunately, was something called the wobblies, which is where they got an acute episode of dizziness during...
That's called... I used to be a diver.
It's different things, but they called it
the wobblies.
The wobblies. And it was a acute vertigo.
Basically. That was the word I was looking for.
It didn't happen a lot, but you know that was something we watched out for, and different countries had different ways of dealing with it,
An equal balance behind your eardrum, is it not?
It's more in the inner ear. The inner ear has three different semicircular canals that are at 90 degrees to each other. So depending on which plane that you're flying in, the balance stones can send different messages. And one thing that could sometimes happen is those stones could get dislodged and send you the wrong message, like this. Although the pressure changes can also do that.
Oh, yeah,
so
for
it's,
sure.
It's that medicine's an art, and so everybody was a little bit different
right.
But, you know, we were able to deal with that when it did come up.
And that's funny you say that. So, you know, to the audience, when you see an air show and these guys go up and they start spinning and flipping, and, I mean, they're just in real rapid succession.
Yeah.
I can only imagine what that does to their inner ear, and that's dangerous if you get the wobblies.
It is.
In that maneuver, right?
Yeah.
I mean, real dangerous.
And so these are professionals. They rarely run into it, but it does happen. And
you ever have to ground anybody as a result?
Yeah, you do sometimes, temporarily,
right?
Until we get it squared away. And but you know, the other thing that's interesting, as you're aging, your arteries are getting a little bit harder, so you're able to tolerate a little bit higher G loads. And these guys were in good shape, but you know, they're not 20 years old. A lot of them are 50 plus or more.
They are. I know.
So even the age wasn't such a limiting factor, and it's exciting for the guys my age, you know, and that may be interested in aerobatics. Your body is not going to give out on you, but you have to acclimate, and you have to build up to it, and you have to train for it. So,
and so as an air show pilot, what class medical do you need to hold?
Most of them have, I think they have first class. I think it depends on what type of show they decide to do. They may allow lower classes for different, they have different waiver heights that they do for,
right,
you know, for different pilots and different, you know, routines. I don't know the level that everybody has, but I would think the first class is
they're all shooting for a first class.
Yeah, that'd be the best class. That's the best plan.
So I know you got a lot of kind of hobbies and interests. Yeah. You're kind of a history buff.
Yes.
Aviation history.
It's one of my weaknesses. Yeah, absolutely.
And again, getting to know you, I know, and I'm gonna go here to camera one, please. Tom just wrote this book, and it is called Sky Raider. And it's about World War I fighter pilots.
Exactly.
And though it is fiction, it is based on true events.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I've never been able to do is interview a World War I fighter pilot.
I have seen a taped interview of the Smithsonian of a couple of the guys, and you know, these guys are real troopers. It's you know, they're flying aircraft. They're, you know, less than a decade since the Wright brothers got off the ground and,
right,
and heavier than air, and now here they are flying high performance fighter planes that are climbing up to 18,000 feet or higher.
Really, and were they that high?
And talking about extreme cold and hypoxia and long duration.
Because no O2, no pressurization, of course. And
right.
Yikes, I didn't realize they went to 18,000 feet.
That's, yeah,
or that's more. That's dangerous in and of itself. So,
yeah.
So because you're so versed on this, I got to ask you a few questions.
Sure.
And what I do know, World War One fighter pilots, at a certain point there, their life expectancy was a little over 3 weeks, or right at 3 weeks, like
exactly.
23 days or something crazy like that.
Yeah.
And what, and again, from my knowledge and the audience, what made it so dangerous? Was it the airplane itself, or was it the enemy?
It was a combination of all of those things. At that, particularly around April 1917, Bloody April, it became known as, the Allies were suffering, or were quoted as having the fighter pilots about a three-week lifespan. Part of the problem was they were facing an exceptionally talented group of German pilots with the Red Baron's Flying Circus.
That was going to be my next question. How did the Germans get ahead?
Well, they had a very good designer, Anthony Fokker, and others. The Allies, we had very good designers as well. Gregory de Havilland in England, and the French designers produced the Nieuport 28, which is one of the aircraft that's pictured on the cover. And the Germans at that time had Albatross fighters and these were a little more capable technically than what we were flying against at the time. So it was a leapfrogging where one side would get pick up some new technology, like when initially they were shooting and they'd shoot their props off because they're trying to shoot a machine gun.
Right.
And then Anthony Fokker, the German designer, came up with
the timing,
an interrupter gear.
Right.
So when they'd shoot, it wouldn't take the prop off. So
that's a good thing.
So they had the advantage over us while that was going on because we didn't know how to do it. So they eventually shot down and captured an Eindecker, one of the Fokker aircraft,
and then we acquired it.
We acquired it somehow through bringing an aircraft down intact.
Right.
And thankfully that allowed us to catch up, and then the different aircraft designs would come out a little faster, a little more maneuverable, a little tougher. The Newport 28 had a reputation of possibly shedding its upper wing fabric in high speed dives. So
yikes.
That was a drawback to that design, but the pilots learned it was a problem, and the builder strengthened that flaw. And just like when the Germans came out with their Fokker triplane, it had some structural failures to start with. So they lost some pilots as well to this development.
Like you say, it's just shortly after the Wright brothers. And talk about a quantum leap in technology.
Yeah.
That was really...
tremendous.
Tremendous. And we think the leaps we've seen in our lifetime really doesn't compare to that first 20 years.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's just scary how they even got guys to go up there and do that with a life expectancy of like 3 weeks.
Well, one of the other issues was they weren't allowed to have parachutes. And
were parachutes invented at that time?
Well, they had them, like the balloon pilots. They had them, so they were around. But the generals felt like the pilots would just jump out and not fight. And
So they didn't let them wear them because they were afraid they'd jump out.
Yeah, they thought they might chicken out, I guess. But
wow,
that was a huge mistake.
No kidding.
Because these aircraft are fabric covered, cotton. They've got castor oil, fuel spilling on them. They're like a flame. They're just wouldn't take much at all to flame them.
Right.
And unfortunately, the pilots had to decide if that happened, what do I do? I can't bail out. I don't have a parachute. But they usually would carry a pistol, and or they would, they'd leave the aircraft voluntarily.
So we're down to just a couple, 3 minutes here. So the book is based around World War I fighter pilots, and I think you said an arc. Give me just a couple minutes on what's in the book and what's cool about it.
Yeah, be happy.
Why you wrote it and why we should read it.
Well, the main character, Duke Thomas, becomes an ace in Newport 28s and the Sopwith triplane. In the process, he starts in France, but gets transferred to the Egyptian front, where General Allenby with the British Expeditionary Forces is fighting another front. While there, he's brought down in the desert after aerial combat. And because of his PhD in archaeology, happens to put a puzzle together and solve one of the greatest mysteries of antiquity, dating back to 2,300 years ago. And so we have dialogue from Caesar and Cleopatra and Alexander the Great and Ptolemy, all these great historical figures. And the book, and you kind of flash back to this whole different time period, and then we come back to the time and the current battles and the pandemic that's going on with the flu.
Oh,
and he manages to survive everything, but in the process, he has a bounty put on his head by one of the Arab tribes that has joined the German battle, and he has a great victory, our main character does, against these troops, and kills one of the guys that's the Sheik's favorite son, who puts a giant bounty up on him, and then when he goes back to Europe, he begins combat again and actually engages the Red Baron's Flying Circus and the Red Baron, and somehow manages to survive almost everything, just not without some combat injuries, and also has the bounty hunters after him for quite a payday.
So, well, that's amazing, and we're about out of time. I tell you, sounds like a good movie to me.
Well, I've had a couple readers say it's like the Indiana Jones of the sky.
Right.
So, and what's always fun is when somebody tells you, I couldn't stop reading it. I was up all night, right.
I have to see if I can talk you out of this, baby.
I bet we work that out.
I'm an avid reader. I love to read.
Be happy to.
And, geez, Tom, thanks for coming by and sharing that with us, and obviously your service to aviation as an AME, and you know, you've got a whole lot more. We could sit and talk to you for another show.
Yeah.
But we're just out of time today. But I really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks for having me, Joel.
Well, happy to do it. So I am Joel Hargis with the Florida Aviation Network here at Sun and Fun 2022 in beautiful Lakeland, Florida. And we got more shows coming tomorrow. This is the last one for today if you're watching live. But check us out in the morning. We'll be back up and look forward to seeing you out there in the audience.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the Florida Aviation Network, an effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and a coalition of local, regional, and national aviation organizations and agencies. Please visit our studio website to hear past programs.